You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis, and today we're going to take a poltergeist trip down a very long hallway. Remember that scene in the movie where Jo Beth Williams runs up the stairs of the house and screams,
"Away from my baby! Get away!"
She runs upstairs, you hear the creepy music. Yeah, that creepy orchestral music of composer Jerry Goldsmith. She sees her kid's room at the end of the hallway. And as she's running toward that room, it's getting farther and farther and farther away. We can't exactly do optical illusions on the radio, but when it comes to COVID-19, that to me is the best way to describe the way this pandemic has gone. It has been a brutal, brutal run down that long hallway. A couple weeks turned into a month, then a month turned into a few months. Now we're 6 months in. More than 250,000 people who have tested positive in LA County, more than 6,200 deaths in that time frame. A half year in, and there's still this pandemic. It seems to be getting better in LA and other parts of the country, but the danger isn't near over, and it could turn really bad again in the fall. Here to update us are a couple of doctors that we've checked in with in the past. Dr. Deborah Prothro-Stith, the Dean and Professor of Medicine over at the College of Medicine at Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science. Doctor, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Oliver T. Brooks is former president of the National Medical Association and Chief Medical Officer at Watts Healthcare. Dr. Brooks, welcome to you, sir.
Thank you for having me back again. It's good to be here.
I'll start with you, because how are things going at Watts Healthcare? Are the numbers up or down? What's your assessment of the virus at the moment?
So you used a great analogy, the scariest movie I've ever seen, Poltergeist. And it is, we're in for the long haul. So, you know, this pandemic is the scariest thing I've seen in a long time. For us over at Watts Healthcare Corporation, I can celebrate the positivity because, you know, we're a community clinic, and we are happy to see these good findings. We are where we are because of the activities, the efforts, the infection control measures that we have taken in this county, specifically at Watts Healthcare Corporation for us. So what it says for us is we just have to keep it up. We have to continue to screen patients. We have to continue to monitor our staff. We have to be very vigilant. So I will say this. We are happy to hear it. Has it affected us on the day-to-day level? Not really, because our job has not stopped.
We had you on back in June, both of you, to discuss how the virus was disproportionately affecting Black and brown communities. We have discussed race being a factor in testing and in treatment as well. And I wonder if you feel like there's been an improvement in that realm.
Well, I can jump in and start because we are still seeing those disparities. And if you look at the mortality rates in LA County, Black and African Americans at 63 per 100,000 and Hispanic and Latino at 87 per 100,000. While the rate of white mortality is at 31 per 100,000. So that overrepresentation is still very much there. And if you look at the poverty rates and mortality, it's not surprising because it's true pretty much across the board for diseases and other problems that we have as a society. But the more poverty, the higher the mortality rate. So that disparities issue is one that's entrenched in who we are as a society, and it's a part of our health system. And, you know, we have to continue to work on it, but it remains a part of the COVID-19 pandemic as well.
And I would like to echo what Dr. Prothro-Stith stated. The disparities developed over decades, over centuries. This pandemic has been around, at least in this country, for 6-8 months. So my thought is that we are having a two-pronged approach. You have to work on these disparities. And one of the issues is racism, and we're seeing that addressed. And we appreciate that. There's a long way to go. If we work hard to reduce the number of COVID cases, even if the percent of African-Americans and Latinos that are dying are higher, the less cases, the less hospitalizations, the less deaths of African-Americans and Latinos. So even though the disparities are there, we can celebrate the decrease. I noted that the case fatality rate dropped from a peak of around 4% to 2%. So I celebrate that. And a raw number, the number of people hospitalized, that number is dropping. That's the number that I follow almost most closely, because how much testing you do, disparities, treatment. When you have the number of people hospitalized dropping, that means the virus is not circulating as much. And I know, therefore, more of our people, therefore, are not in the hospital and not dying.
Yeah, we're knocking on wood for that, and hoping that gets better and better. I know when you look back to March and April, you know, the early days of the pandemic, what has changed, Dr. Brooks, in your eyes? I mean, do we have a better handle on the science of the virus, of quarantining, of treatment? I know there are thoughts of maybe a vaccine in the coming weeks and months, if not at the early part of next year. I mean, where are we?
So, your analogy of the hallway and poltergeist. So, we are gaining ground. So, the three W's: wear a mask, wash your hands, and watch your distance. We are seeing the direct effect of simple measures. It's not remdesivir, it's not convalescent plasma, it's not ventilators. It's the simple infection control. So that's what I'm saying. For me, I love this success, but all it means is that what we're doing is working. We have to keep it up. That hallway, at the end of that hallway, is a vaccine that is safe and effective. Once we have that, we get to what's called herd immunity, which is approximately, for this virus, 70% coverage of the community, of the country, of the state, of the world, however you want to look at it, but 70%. So that's where we find ourselves right now. We have to focus on the simple infection control mitigation, and then we have to get a safe and effective vaccine. And not until we get our arms around those two will we get to the end of that hall and open up the door, and the door shows, you know, sunshine and back to a degree of normalcy.
Dr. Prothro-Stith, I mean, throughout the conversation, we've done a lot of backward looking back to 6 months ago. And as a country, we're nearing 200,000 deaths. That is a grim, grim number, and it's likely to go even higher. And I wonder if you'd like to weigh in on where you think we might be 6 months from now.
Well, I think it depends a lot on what we do. If we are able to continue, especially as a county, because not all places are experiencing this decline in deaths and hospitalizations and testing average, 7-day testing average. So I think as a society, if we can continue to do the mask wearing, the social distancing, opening in some very rational ways, we'll make it to that open door where there's sunshine behind it.
Right. Well, I mean, I think a lot of folks think that the vaccine will be, you know, this panacea, that once we get to that, you know, fewer people will have it, but it will still be around. It will still be deadly for some people if they get it. Certainly not everyone will be vaccinated. We know that. So Dr. Brooks will still be in this, just better at coping with it?
Yes, I think it's a learning curve. As we move forward, we're learning more and we're gaining experience. I do believe strongly that 6 months from now, we will be in a better place than we are now. The problem is that some of this has been politicized. So we have to be clear and follow the science and not the politics. I mean, there are states in this country now where the rates are much higher than they are in California, simply because more people are not following simple infection control. Overall, as a nation, I firmly believe that 6 months from now, we will be in a better place than we are now.
Let's hope so. Knock on some wood to get there. I want to thank you both, Dr. Brooks, Dr. Oliver T. Brooks, the Chief Medical Officer over at Watts Healthcare, Dr. Deborah Prothro-Stith, the Dean and Professor of Medicine over at the College of Medicine at Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Take you as my husband.
Take you as my husband.
I love you.
Love you.
Honor you.
Honor you.
And to cherish you.
And to cherish you.
Hold hands.
This is a video of a recent Sherman Oaks backyard wedding.
They both love exercise, adventure, and travel.
Just like you, the 100 guests had to tune in remotely, since that's, of course, how we do weddings in the age of COVID. It was at the bride's grandfather's house, and Grandpa made a speech.
Find their way forward. An example is this wedding planned by Miriam and Sagar, despite the limitations that are caused by our present challenging pandemic. With their love for each other,
we got married at my grandparents' house. We got married in their front yard and had our reception, I say that with quote marks, in the backyard. And I got ready in my uncle's old bedroom. Actually, no, it was my dad's old bedroom. And Sagar got married.
Miriam Hirschman and Sagar Yadov tied the knot in front of just five local loved ones. No parents, no other family but grandparents. Everyone else had to catch it live on Zoom. Well, these days, engaged couples have to decide. Do they postpone their pre-pandemic plans indefinitely? Do they scrap them entirely and make a pandemic plan like Miriam and Sagar? None of those options look great for the photographers and the wedding planners that rely on the $72 billion industry to pay their bills. KCRW's Kaylee Wells reports on how couples are still getting hitched, despite the pandemic, and how the vendors are still working to make these unprecedented weddings special.
Between Sagar Yadav and Miriam Hirschman, there are plenty of traditions to fit into one wedding. Yadav is from India, Hirschman from Thailand, and she was raised Jewish. And they did it all.
And we made our ceremony like a mixture of Jewish as well as Hindu / Thai tradition.
Yeah, like we called it a Hindu wedding.
Yeah. Because it had customs that, you know, pertain to Jewish tradition, and then we had the garland exchange and the red dot that comes from Hindu as well as Thai. So it just, we made this ours, which is why it was very special.
They had to cancel plans for a traditional wedding in India with hundreds of people in November. Instead, Hirschman's teenage cousin did her hair following a YouTube tutorial. The couple played their first dance, Wild by John Legend, off an iPad. The reception was catered by one of the groom's favorite restaurants, Domino's Pizza. They talked about Wingstop Chicken too, but that's not kosher.
I thought I was going to be a bridezilla, and I was not. The flowers were not the exact color I wanted. That was perfectly fine. It was still beautiful. And we went to the dollar store for decorations and did a bunch of DIY things. So yeah. it was actually
it was
so
a fun
perfect.
Project.
LA photographer Jessica Franz shot their photos. She's been in the business for more than 25 years, but says this year's pandemic has added a new layer of stress to weddings like this one.
We had people on Zoom just watching it, you know, and then we did a little Zoom speech thing afterwards. It was really emotional because, you know, they were crying and it was just like, ah.
She's glad for the business because she's only doing about a quarter of the wedding she normally would. They're also a fraction of the size, which means fewer hours of work. On top of all that, clients are looking for better deals amidst an economic recession.
People just don't have the money, so they, you know, they want to pay half of what you usually charge. And I lost a lot of clients because of that, you know, and I'm already giving discounts. I'm not charging my travel fees anymore. I'm giving more edits for my packages and all these things. So that sometimes is just not enough.
She says the level of work isn't sustainable and she'll rely on her savings to make ends meet this year. But at least the work is still coming in. Other vendors aren't so lucky. Jessica Carrillo is an event planner based in L.A. She's still getting weekly inquiries from couples about next year and even the year after that, but she's responding with uncertainty. And uncertainty doesn't sell.
It's so frustrating because I'm a planner. That's what I do. I plan. This is a completely unpredictable roller coaster. And so you can get on the ride. Maybe I'll be able to have 10 people. Maybe I'll be able to have 20. Maybe I'll be able to have 100. Maybe I won't be able to have anyone. Maybe it'll get shut down the day before and the venue won't be able to host it. So I'm not just going to book them and take their money and say, we'll figure this out later.
Even in the best of times, planning a wedding is high stakes. So many things can ruin the big day. Add in a global pandemic.
I think worst case scenario. So that's what I do as a planner. If my worst case scenario is somebody in the wedding or a guest of the wedding dying or somebody in my family or, you know, somebody, I can't do that. Like, I don't want to plan that wedding. I don't want to be in that headline.
Right now, rules for how to gather safely keep changing. You can't gather with anyone outside the home. But religious ceremonies of up to 100 people are allowed outdoors. So a reception wouldn't be allowed unless the vendor has a restaurant license. Then they can seat tables of 6 outdoors, as long as everyone's masked and nobody's sitting with people they don't live with. That still means no dancing, no mingling.
It's a very giant gray area in terms of the event industry.
Nicole Stubbs manages LA River Studios by the LA River in Glassell Park, which typically hosts weddings every weekend. She says people are renting out Airbnb houses since venues like hers can't take bookings.
If you allow it and have guidelines, it'll probably stop these bootleg events that are happening every single weekend and bringing it back into the places where people are permitted and operated to do so professionally. And like, let's stop this DIY thing happening and bring it back to the professionals.
But even if local governments changed their minds, weddings wouldn't appear overnight.
So it's not like if LA County decided or the state decided, hey, guess what? We're going to allow weddings tomorrow, that we could just open our doors and we're going to have a wedding walk in our doors tomorrow. This is a planning event. So then you have to talk to the client, all of their vendors that were contracted. You know, can the balloon guy come? Can the linen person come? Can the officiant make it on this day? We need to fill a space. And who wants to do that right now?
You know what's a lot easier than party planning in a pandemic? Eloping. And if you're one of the people who marries those couples, you're busy.
I'm pretty popular. It's not like I lack for business, but this is unprecedented.
Marie Burns-Holzer is an ordained officiant. She's only doing socially distant elopements now because of her own underlying health conditions. She's sold out for the rest of 2020, half booked for 2021 already, marrying people 5 or 6 days a week.
It is easily 100% over what I normally do. So I'm double what my normal booking capacity at this time is. It's crazy.
Half the couple she's marrying weren't planning to elope originally. That brings more than just joy to wedding day.
There's a lot of kind of grief and disappointment because this isn't what they originally planned. Or even if it was, it's not the way they thought it would be. Because we have to be masked. And so many people have envisioned as they're saying their vows and seeing each other's full faces. But once we actually get in the ceremony, there's something so powerful about being able to celebrate something good right now. And to know that they have endured this together and they are choosing to continue to endure whatever comes. And there's something really powerful about that message when right now the world just kind of feels like a whole field of dumpster fires.
As for Sagar Yadav and Miriam Hirschman, they said the circumstances forced by the pandemic ended up making their day more special.
Having a smaller and more intimate setting allowed us to really enjoy each other's company. Like, I've been to a couple weddings where I feel like the bride and groom end up, you know, saying hello to like a billion people and not get to enjoy their day together as much. I really appreciated not having to entertain people, but kind of just have our moment. Yeah, it was like so special.
Plus, they say there's plenty of time for another formal ceremony in India and a reception in Thailand, so their families can celebrate with them, too, someday. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells. I wanna drive you wild, wild, wild. Wild,
wild, wild. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The harbor at Dana Point is getting a facelift, but not everyone's happy about it. Let's head to the county of Orange. The California Coastal Commission voted unanimously to approve a redevelopment plan for the harbor at Dana Point, but some commissioners and locals are worried that it's not giving enough access to the general public, people who, of course, can't afford the big yachts and the marina fees. Gustavo Arellano is with us from his yacht. He's a columnist for the LA Times, and every week he's here for KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Let's be clear, you don't have a yacht, right?
Not even a dinghy, sorry.
Not even a dinghy. Can you give us a snapshot, Gustavo, of the redevelopment plans that the Coastal Commission approved? I mean, what's going to change at the harbor there in Dana Point?
So a bit of background about Dana Point Harbor. So it was built in the late 60s, early 70s, and totally killed the surfing culture there. Like the old timers remember as Big Dana for the huge wave. So it's kind of been a black hole ever since. It's just a place where people go and put their boats. If you go to the coast in Orange County, you usually go to Newport or Huntington or even San Clemente. So Dana Point has been trying for decades to bring more tourism and even more locals from across Orange County down there. So about 20 years ago, Orange County, the government decided we're going to redevelop Dana Point Harbor. We need to do it. Here we are 20 years later. First, the county was going to do it all on its own, but then they entered in a very Orange County thing, a public-private partnership that will allow the redevelopment of the harbor for, and then lease it to this LLC for the next 66 years.
What has taken so long if it's been 20 years in the making?
Let's not forget, this is the coast. So the California Coastal Commission, anything involving the coast in California takes years, decades even. I mean, up the coast in Huntington Beach, of course, you have the desalination plant we talked about a couple weeks ago that has also been taking about 20 years roughly. And also in Orange County, though, the big issue was a lot of residents had a problem with the county allocating resources to all the way down in Dana Point. Dana Point is very far removed from the rest of Orange County. It's in south Orange County. Further south is San Clemente. After that is Camp Pendleton. So there's been a lot of issues regarding the funding. Some people were afraid that the county would be pulling money away from the rest of the county park system into the Dana Point Harbor revitalization. But ostensibly, all of those problems are going to be solved by this public-private partnership.
All right. So you're mentioning that people have concerns about this. I know some folks at the Coastal Commission have voiced concerns. People at the harbor itself have voiced concerns vis-a-vis access. Right. So tell us more about all these other concerns out there.
One of the proposals is to eliminate about 130 boat spaces to make bigger boat spaces. In other words, going for those luxury yachts that you mentioned earlier, because nowadays in the yachting world, the bigger, the better. So immediately you have boaters themselves saying, hey, we're not going to have as much access as we used to. On the other hand, going back to what I said earlier about concerns over access, one of the things that the developers said is we're going to make a program to bring underprivileged youth down to Dana Point Harbor and give them hands-on training, although that's not really specified what that hands-on training is, and maybe 10% of them will actually learn how to do sailing. And it was an interesting exchange between the developer and the Coastal Commission, because the Coastal Commission is like, 10%, that's not really a lot, that's not really a big guarantee to create equity down there. And the developer said, well, it's because there's not really much of a demand under underprivileged people to be boating. And the commissioner responded, well, maybe because they've never had that chance to begin with. So there is that concern. Again, since it's all the way down in Dana Point in South Orange County, how are kids from Anaheim or Santana supposed to have the access to go down there?
Are there any other people who are opposing what's going on there?
It's really those two, the people who are fighting for underprivileged youth and then the voters themselves, because the rest of Dana Point, they want that money. They want that revenue. Again, the last time I was there, oh boy, it must have been 7 years ago. And I went there for a pizza restaurant that no longer exists there. That shows how lively Dana Point Harbor is. I mean, the last big thing that happened at Dana Point Harbor actually just happened this year, which was the burning of a boat, a replica of a 19th century sailing ship that a lot of thousands of elementary school kids from across Orange County would go to visit to see how life was in the 19th century. That burned down. That was literally the only reason why people had to go to Dana Point Harbor.
Well, we've talked obviously about how climate change is expected to cause a sea level rise. That affects, of course, a lot of coastal communities, limiting some coastal development plans. I know the Coastal Commission is certainly very aware of it. Do you know if that was taken into account this time in Dana Point?
Oh, the climate change doesn't exist in Orange County, so why would it be? I mean, this is something that the county and the city has been fighting for 20 years. Again, you have the public-private partnership, so that basically stamps an anything-goes attitude in Orange County. And besides, it's a harbor. There's ships there. So if there is climate change, well, you just get on those ships and then you go away.
Gustavo Arellano, you're going away now. Columnist for the LA Times, and every week he's here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, as always, thank you.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, saving tactile, hard copy, personal communication while trying to save the post office, too. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us what you think and join a growing list of folks who are getting this program delivered straight to the inbox. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geist, Desmond Taylor, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time and attention, and your ears, too. Have a great night.